and say that today is the 7th of June, 2013. We are at the home of a colleague, Michael Gross, in Singlet Park, Minnesota. And I'm starting the first part of an interview of a scientist by the name of Nico, N-I-C-O, Niebuhring, N-I-B-B-E-R-I-N-G. And we're going to spend some time talking about his career in science in general and mass spectrometry in particular. And so with that much of an introduction, I'd just like to go ahead and start with how the very early part of your life, your family, and particularly their interests or their attitude towards education and intellectual pursuit in general. So you were born in probably what,
29 of May, 1938.
Okay.
In Zaandam.
Okay, and how do you spell that?
Z-A-A-N-D-A-M.
Z-A-A-N-D-A-M.
M.
Very good. And that is in which country?
It is in the Netherlands. It is about 15 kilometers north from Amsterdam.
Uh-huh. And your parents, what did they do for a living?
My father was a factory man. And my mother did, before she married, she made clerical garbs, I think.
So this would be for people that were in a religious...
For the Roman Catholic Church.
Okay.
Yeah?
Very good. And can we have the names of those
people? Yes. The name of my mother is Hendrika Klank.
H-E-N-D-R-I-K-I-T-A.
Yeah, Hendrika. Yeah.
And the last name was?
Klank, but I will spell it.
Yes.
C-L-Y-N-K.
C-L-Y-N-K.
It is a strange name in the Netherlands. Yeah. Because it is possibly Scottish in origin.
Hmm.
But that depends on how much I can say about that. Because we didn't figure it out, where we came from. That was a family who did that. And that went back until somewhere in the 1300s. And they found that we were descendants from the St. Clairs in Caithness, in Scotland, and the man was Earl of Caithness and the Orkney Islands.
So how do you spell Caithness?
C-A-I-T-H-N-E-S-S.
Okay, very interesting. So there's this...
It's a long, long way ago, and they had a castle, of course, there at that time. And as I said, he was the early Earl of Caithness. And there is the Gulf of St. Clair.
Glove?
The Gulf of St. Clair.
You know?
Yeah, Gulf of St. Clair. And let us call it a bay area. Hey?
Mm-hmm.
And that St. Clair, that sounds then, that is somewhere connected with the name Klink in the end.
Mm-hmm.
But the black sheep of that family became ship surgeon.
Uh-huh.
And he ended up in his... well, his later on born children, etc., that I don't know, but in France.
Mm.
And then with the Huguenots,
okay. They
came to the Netherlands. And so my grandfather, his name was Klank also.
Okay.
Well, he pronounced it as Klank.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in the south of the Netherlands. And therefore the name of my mother is then Hendrika Klank.
Oh my, okay.
I don't know many other... four names. I mean, this was her first name and then the family name.
Uh-huh. And then your father?
My father was Dirk Niebuhring.
D?
I-R-K.
D-I-R-K.
Dirk
mm-hmm.
Niebuhring.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I don't know whether he had more four names, but that is at least known.
Mm-hmm.
And he was born in the Rijp.
And that's spelled?
D-E. And then space, and then R, I, G, P.
Okay.
That is the Dutch I. So you pronounce it as ripe.
Ah, okay.
An Englishman would say, oh, it is ripe.
Okay.
You understand?
R-I-G-P.
Yeah. Well, you know the Y, we would say if you put two dots on it, then you have something like an I.
Okay.
The ripe. Okay. In North Holland.
That's in?
Like Zaandam, North Holland is the province in the Netherlands.
Oh, okay, North Holland. North,
that also holds for Zaandam.
Ah, okay, okay. That Zaandam, how do you spell that one?
Zaandam?
Zaandam.
Yeah, Z-A-A-N-D-A-M, yes.
I got that at the beginning.
Okay, no, no, okay.
Okay, very good, very good. And so, what was their educational background?
My father had only elementary school.
Okay.
And I think my mother had at least an elementary school, and then perhaps a school where you learned about household managing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And to prepare clothes and these kind of things. Yeah. So it was a lower based education, hey?
Okay.
Following the elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can say, of course, to you, Mike, there was nobody in our family who had studied before, had an academic career, etc.
Okay.
That is, yeah?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I must also say that I was born in 1938, so in 1940 the Second World War started. So during that time, during the Second World War, I went to school in 1944, to the elementary school. But it was a very hard and cold winter.
Mm-hmm.
So you could not immediately start the term at school because the school didn't work.
Mm-hmm. There was didn't have any heat? Or
yeah, that was one of the problems, of course. And I also must say then that why I wanted to learn or to eager to learn things, I asked my father to buy a book on simple mathematics that you learned at school and the Dutch language.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother, she had the capability to explain to me. So I learned from her to learn do some mathematics and Dutch language when the time that I didn't go to school.
Okay, so this was like when you were probably
six years old. Yes.
Okay, so it was a little bit like almost what we call homeschooling here.
Homeschooling, because at that time it was difficult to get to school. That changed, of course, in May 1945, because springtime, then you could go to school. And then in the first class of the elementary school, I remember that the teacher, she was a lady, suddenly on the 5th of May, she did see a Dutch flag over the river Zaan, because Zaandam, hey?
Yeah.
There is a stream called the Zaan.
Okay, so the Zaandam refers to like a dam at the Zaan
River? Yeah, Zaan River.
So over the river?
Yeah, there she did see suddenly the Dutch flag, that meant that we were free, liberated.
Oh, okay.
And that I remember very well as a child.
Yeah, so prior to that time, you were under what governmental jurisdiction before the Dutch were liberated?
Yeah, we were occupied by the Germans.
So this was up until 1945. Okay.
The 5th of May, that was the liberation.
Okay.
Yeah. So the occupation by Germans was then over.
Okay.
Yeah. So I remember also as a child at the school square, the bombers coming over the Lancasters.
Mm-hmm.
They came over the school very low. You could almost see the pilot and the man who was shooting. Hey?
Uh-huh.
But what I also must say, I'm the oldest one of a family of 8 children.
Okay.
What was now the problem? I think the family had too many children, so my mother, although she could teach me, she was very inert in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And my father was a very nervous person. He always went out to get food. That was difficult at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Because you had to go on a bicycle, but there were of course many problems to keep the bicycle running.
Mm-hmm.
And then to go through the country where there were always Germans to pick up food from farmers. And so in that way, we got food. But I remember that after the war was over, I had to go to the south of the Netherlands to an advent, nuns, to get again in a good shape, because I was not in a good shape because of malnutrition.
Okay.
Yeah?
So this would have been 1940...
45. The begin, well, after the, yeah. And then, yeah, what I did, I, as the oldest child, I tried in the morning to make the food for the brothers and sisters, because that, yeah, I don't understand why my mother was so inert. And then, when they were fed, then I started to clean up. And then I started to do learning about mathematics and language. And don't ask me why. I mean, why did I that? Yeah.
Yeah. But you were pretty young too at that time.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. But then my father took me at the end of 45, so in December, to his sister, so my aunt, and my uncle. They lived in another section of Zaandam,
okay,
called Het Kalf. Yeah, I don't know whether that is important for the interview.
Well, let's get the name, the spelling down.
Yeah, so that section was called Het Kalf. It is een comma, upper comma, T.
Okay.
And then Kalf, K-A-L-F.
K-A-L-F, okay.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. And so I had their holidays.
Okay.
So my father took me on his bicycle to the aunt and uncle. And then 2 weeks later, he came back and he asked me whether I wanted to stay there. And then I said yes.
So they had no children?
Yeah, they had five children.
Okay.
But I said yes. And later on, of course, I thought, why did I say yes? And I discussed it also with Michael, because we know a lot from each other. I think that at my own parents, it was not organized. I tried to organize. And it had to do, of course, with the circumstances of the war, etc. You can understand.
Yeah.
And now I came in a family where it was organized. Mm-hmm. So therefore, I might have said unconsciously, yes, yeah, I would like to stay here. And then I grew up there. So I'm the only one of all the brothers and sisters who grew up in a normal family, because the sisters went to, how do you call it, convents run by nuns. And the brothers went to institutions run by brothers.
Oh, wow, okay.
And that's another thing. The parents, so they... I was for the Children Protection Organization. They took care of these children from families where the parents could not do it. So the parents were not allowed anymore to raise their kids.
Ah, okay.
I hope that it's clear. Eh?
Yeah, protection. It's kind of like the family was just not functioning well enough to...
But not not in a way that the parents were nasty or said, well, we don't take care of them, but they could not.
They didn't have the resources.
Didn't have the resource and the circumstances, because I know, but it is perhaps not to write it down. My father had always problems that has happened. Because he always said that my children have a good position in life. Yeah. So that was saying to himself, okay, that happened, but fortunately it went okay. Yeah.
So what about your other brothers and sisters? Are there, they went obviously in different ways.
Yeah.
They all were, raised okay, and they were...
They had... Now, one of them, he became a sailor man, and he was allowed to go, when he was 17 years old, to go on the Holland-America Line ship company. And that was exceptional, because most of the time, these children were held in these institutions, but he had a very good influence on the other children. So they allowed him to go on the to make trips with the Holland America Line, and later on he ended up to be an engineer in a tugboat, etc. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then the two sisters were twin sisters from each other. They did go to school and then they married. Also the youngest one, so elementary school and then married. I had a very good brother, Hank, but he passed away because of a brain infarct. Yeah, that is of course a problem. And one sister is living in Sardinia in Italy because she married an Italian person. And then I have a brother in Canada, in Alberta, but we write him, but we never get an answer. So, that can also happen.
I was just in Canada a couple of weeks ago interviewing Paul Cabrali.
So that was
very interesting.
Yeah.
It was fun. So basically, your aunt and uncle were probably the strongest influence then.
Yeah.
In, from like age six or so.
Yeah.
On,
yes. Seven. Yes.
And
their background was they also went only to elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
So, Tante Nel in the Dutch. The official name is Petronella.
P.
E. T. R. O. N. E. L. L. A. Petronella. Nickname Nail.
And
then we had Uncle Piet.
Piet.
P-I-E-T.
P-I-E-T, okay.
And the family name was Piet Konijn.
P?
K-O-N.
K-O-N.
And then itch, you know, the I-G, M.
Okay.
The strange I, Konijn. Piet Konijn.
Okay, which is king in...
Konijn is rabbit.
Rabbit?
Yeah, Konijn.
Okay. Okay.
And he was also a factory man. But he had also his own animals, like goats and pigs and, all these kind of things. And the aunt, both my father, his sisters and brothers, they were became very young orphans.
Mm.
And so Aunt Nell, call her, she worked also with a farmer. But my father had also to work with a farmer, because that was the way in which that happened with these children. And in some way he hated farmers, and I think he had a very bad childhood with farmers. But okay, that is not so important. But the thing was, so they called, I went to the elementary school in het kalf, that section. The headmaster of that school, he did see that I did very well in some way, and the headmaster came to my aunt and uncle to discuss whether I could go to high school, because that was his idea. Both the uncle and aunt, nobody went to such a school. So when I heard that it is named Hoger Burgerschool, Higher Citizen School, you understand if I translate it. And I heard that sitting in the room, and as a child, I thought, but I don't belong to the higher citizens, because I came from a very simple family. HBS, or high school, that was, for the aunt and uncle, another world. He was an authority. At these times, and headmaster of a school was of course an authority in the eyes of my uncle and aunt.
So how does he spell that school?
The elementary school, the headmaster. So he recommended that I should go to the HBS, Hoger Burgerschool. I can say it in Hoger H O G E R, dit is higher, Burger, B-U-R-G-E-R,
okay.
Citizen,
okay.
School, S-C-H-O-O-L.
Yes.
Yeah?
Okay.
And that was a part of het Zaanlands Lyceum.
Okay, what's that about?
Zaanlands Lyceum, so it has a division of eight, if I say Hoger Burgerschool, we call it HBS, of course, okay. Yeah? HBS. And that was part of het Zaanlands Lyceum, Z-A-A-N-L-E-N-D-S.
Okay.
Yeah, it's an adjective, yeah?
Yeah.
And then Lyceum, L, then the Y, hey, the, your English Y, C-E-U-M, Lyceum.
Okay, very good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so I had to do an examination to enter that school.
But this was after you were finished, completed eighth grade?
The elementary school.
The elementary school.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. And I passed that examination. That was okay. So in that way, I came to high school.
Now, this headmaster, he obviously recognized talent.
Yeah.
Do you remember his name?
Yeah, yeah. Van Oerle.
Okay.
Master. Now, V-A-N.
V?
V-A-N.
N.
Space. And then O-E-R-L-E. Oerle.
Okay.
Yeah? Oerle.
Oerle.
Van Oerle.
Van Oerle. So he was instrumental in recognizing.
Very instrumental.
Okay.
Very instrumental.
Do you know if he did this for other students?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so he kind of was picking up.
Yeah, 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 yeah. There were more from het Kalf who went to high school.
So that was kind of his job, is to make sure that.
Yeah, yeah. There was it was also an, how do you call it, a strict headmaster, of course. Yeah, you know how that works, yeah. If he said, you know, then. But now he took care of these, that he looked which students or, the children who could do it, and then he took action.
Okay.
That was very cool. So he's instrumental. As you say, he's been instrumental.
Very good. So did you go to a particular high school, higher citizen school, or was there just one that everybody went to at that time?
No, in Zaanlands Lyceum was well known for the region of Zaandam.
Okay.
Yeah?
Okay.
And then, of course, you start in the first year, the first class. And then, after half a year, then conrector, you have a rector.
Mm-hmm.
And conrector.
So what is, how do you spell that?
Rector, R-E-C-T-O-R.
And then the other one is?
Conrector, that means C-O-N-R-E-C-T-O-R. The okay. Conrector was responsible for the gymnasium division. So now you know, see, Mike, Zaanlands Lyceum, hey, the HBS and the gymnasium.
Oh, right.
And the conrector, he asked my aunt and uncle, including myself, to come over to discuss the following. He wanted that I would participate in the program to see whether I could do gymnasium.
Mm-hmm.
Now, yeah, you know, the aunt and uncle, what did they say? If the conrector is saying that is, yeah. And I was eager to learn in some way, yeah? So I thought that it was a nice idea.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, I participated, and then I ended up to in the second class that I really went over to the gymnasium.
Mm-hmm.
Conrector De Vreese was the name, the conrector.
And this is how do you spell his name?
D-E, hey, de again, hey, this is like de.
Mm-hmm.
De Vreese, V-R-E-E-S-E.
Okay.
And he was a specialist in Indo-Germanic languages.
Okay.
13 of them he managed to, yeah. But he gave also art and history from the Middle East.
Mm.
He taught Latin in Greece, Greek of course, that was no problem. And I must say in 54, that is also what I remember very well, about art and religions. You know, he pointed out in Jerusalem that was a difficult place that we might expect to get problems because there were the Islam, Jewism, and Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And as a child, he had very interesting stories.
Oh, yeah.
And that he told that, yeah, in some way, perhaps he indicated problems. Yeah, we have had the Second World War, so perhaps that has also a reason unconsciously in your mind. But
so he kind of foresaw that that portion of the Middle East was going to be
a difficult situation there.
Yeah.
And that is nowadays true, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But then if you have been 4 years on the gymnasium, so you've got Latin, Greek, history, English, German, French, mathematics, chemistry, you name it. Then, after 4 years, you could make a choice whether you will take the alpha direction. That means the old languages,
okay.
Latin, Greek as main part,
okay.
Or you took the science part.
Okay.
So I took, so alpha is the direction languages.
So like, is it alpha as in Greek alpha? Or
alpha, yeah, Greek alpha, yeah.
Okay.
Gymnasium alpha or gymnasium beta.
Oh, beta.
So beta.
So
beta was the science part.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you still got Greek and Latin, but less than at the alpha.
So alpha was like liberal arts or
philosophy, for example.
Yeah, yeah? Okay, sure.
You had to translate Homer.
Okay.
You did read, we read Caesar and you know.
Classical
education, yes. Yeah.
So you chose the beta.
Then I was at an age that I decided myself to take beta. Yeah.
Okay. So this was probably about what you were at this time.
54.
So 18, 16, 17. 18.
In 56, I was 18.
Okay.
So I was 16 then. Yeah, at that time that I decided that.
Okay. And so I noticed that even in the gymnasium, you had quite a bit of language exposure in modern languages.
Yeah.
So you grew up in Amsterdam.
Zaandam, yeah.
So you spoke, what was your native language as a child?
Dutch. Yeah.
So, but when you went to school, you learned English, French, and German.
Yeah, that was in high school.
In high school.
Yeah.
Okay, so even, I mean... Well, of course, I guess German was not as hard to learn as French and English.
No, yeah, as a child, I have not had a problem with that. I mean, to hate the Germans, I don't like to have that in interview because I have very good friends also in Germany. But no, that feeling I didn't have. The teacher in German language was a good teacher. And in some way... it is a language was, in grammar, it was like mathematics for me, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
With, you could say, in das, in dem, you know, all these kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have that in English, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So, no, there were no bad feelings from my side. Perhaps I didn't realize enough, that is another thing, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But okay, the decision was made to take beta, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And so I had two teachers at that high school. They were all very good, Mike. They were really very good.
Mm-hmm.
But the teacher Simons, S-I-M-O-N-S,
mm-hmm.
That was the teacher in mathematics and physics.
Mm-hmm.
That was an excellent teacher. So... that motivated me more and more into the beta sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had another teacher, Mensink, M-E-N-S-I-N-K. He was the teacher in chemistry.
Mm-hmm. And I guess both of these guys made a very strong influence on...
They were, again, instrumental for me to say, I have to take that part of science, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Not biology, we had also, of course, biology, you know that, hey?
Mm-hmm.
But these were attracting, studies.
Mm-hmm.
But he educated us, especially Simons, in a way that you did the final examination and we were prepared for a university study.
Mm-hmm.
That was at that time, if you took gymnasium, that was followed by university. You were simply prepared for an academic study.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I must say, I made a choice to go to the University of Amsterdam, because that was close to Zaandam. You know, it is a very small country. So I stayed with the uncle and aunt and went by train or by motorbike later up and down to Amsterdam.
So how far was that?
That's about 15 to 20 kilometers. Okay. One way, one way.
Okay.
I had to cross the North Sea Canal. That was a canal made in the 30s from a long time ago between Amsterdam and Haber IJmuiden. I think at the end of the 1800 or something like that.
Harbor,
but okay.
How do you spell that, harbor?
IJmuiden, yeah, that is again the I-G M-U-I-D-E-N.
Okay.
So there was a canal made, I don't know the year in which that was made, between Amsterdam and IJmuiden to get ships from the North Sea to Amsterdam.
Okay.
Because, you know, in the past, if you go back the Golden Age, then ships came to Amsterdam via the North Sea. They had to go north from the Netherlands and then go into the South Sea, and that was the way to get to Amsterdam. But when that canal was made, then they could directly come from the North Sea into Amsterdam.
Ah, okay.
Yeah? So I made a choice for the University of Amsterdam, but then the rector also, he came in. I remember that in the last class of the gymnasium, those who were interested but didn't have, let's say, the money to pay to enter the university, you could get forms, you could fill in and then send it to The Hague, to the Ministry of Education and Science, ask for a grant, a rentloos voorschot, so that is, you could get money, you didn't have to pay interest for that, it was a loan, then you could start to study, and then if your study was over, then you could pay back, because then you would have a job, that loan from the government, yeah? So I did that, so I asked for a rentloos voorschot.
Oh, no.
Yeah?
How do you spell?
Well, rent, so it means a loan where you don't have to pay interest.
Okay.
For the money. But I can spell it if you want.
Yeah, let's put it in.
Renteloos voorschot. So that is R-E-N-T-E-L-O-O-S. So that's the adjective.
Okay.
And then voorschot, V-O-O-R-S-C-H-O-T.
Okay.
So that was a prepayment. Yeah? They said, okay, here you have the money. Right. Later on you will pay back. Yeah?
Okay. So how much was, what did it cost to go to school then?
Now, yeah, I don't remember that anymore exactly. You had to pay a sum fee. But there is another problem that I would like to mention to you.
Well, let's mention that.
I sent it to The Hague, having filled in the forms. But it had to be signed by a legal person.
Oh, okay.
That was not me, of course.
Uh-huh.
Now, so I asked my uncle, Piet, Piet Konijn, could you sign? And my aunt and my uncle, they always said, Nippy will do best. Hey? So they could not understand what was going on, but I filled it in, and they signed, because I will do it. Okay, it will be okay. Nippy was the nickname, Nippy.
So,
Nippy.
N-I-P-P-I-E.
If I, that's really Nippy, Nippy, Nippy.
Okay.
There is an abbreviation of some way from Nibbering. Nippy is doing okay. So he signed. And then I started to study at the University of Amsterdam. But a few months later, and I think that was October, November 56, then a person, Frasenstorm, came along. And now I have to explain you, it's a complicated story. I was on the Children Protection Organization.
Okay.
Yeah? So my uncle and my aunt, they got money for that, to for clothes, etc. And every year, Mr. Frasenstorm, he came from the Children Protection Organization, once per year to my uncle and aunt to discuss, of course. I was there.
So how do you spell his name?
Frasestorm, eh? So there are two words. F-R-A-A-S-E, Frase.
Okay.
And then S-T-O-R-M, Storm.
Okay.
Two words, eh?
Sure.
Frase, Storm.
Okay.
And he was a nice man. But then he had a serious discussion with me. Because he said, went for study to the University of Amsterdam. I didn't discuss that with the Children of Protection organization.
Mm.
That didn't come up in my mind to do that.
Yeah.
And then he said, why not teacher head to a school for teachers, etc. And for me that was strange because I decided myself.
Yeah.
I thought.
Yeah.
But he said then, but you submitted forms to The Hague, to the Minister of Education and Science, and that was not signed legally. I said, not signed legally? I said, Uncle Pete signed.
Mm-hmm.
I thought Uncle Pete is my guard. Mm-hmm. Guard is the right word, I think, isn't it?
Guardian.
Guardian. Mm-hmm. But he said, no, that's not true. So, from my 7 years until 18 years, I assumed that Uncle Pete was the guardian,
mm-hmm.
but it was not true.
Hmm.
So therefore, I had violated the law in something like that. And then I noticed they had to pay longer for me because study will take time.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that. And then I said, if there is a money problem, that's not a problem for me, because I will distribute newspapers,
mm-hmm.
because I have decided to study
mm-hmm.
at the university.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a little bit stubborn, hey? because I, and then, okay, yeah? My aunt Neil, she was always for harmony, because I thought the guardian, what I have to do? I am here from 7 years until 18, I've never seen him.
Yeah.
So I said to my aunt, when Frasestorm was gone, I would like to see that guy, because he has not shown up in 11 years. But my aunt convinced me that I should nevertheless go, you know, and I said in the end, I went by a motorbike to the university, and then on the way back, then I went to the address where he lived, in Zaandam, and of course I did ring, no sound, nobody there. I went to the aunt where I lived, and I said to my aunt, he was not there and I will not go anymore. Over.
Mm-hmm.
And after 3 weeks, I heard he was passed away, so I've never seen him.
So you had a guardian that you didn't ever know?
No.
But basically, you were able to get out from under the problem because he says, I'll just go ahead and work.
Yeah.
Did you have to then give up the loan?
No. I continued the study.
Mm-hmm.
So the rentless voorschot I got.
Okay.
So, but there is an additional thing, and then I think the story is more or less complete, because I had not only to do with the Ministry of Education and Science, but also with the Ministry of juridical things, because of the Children of Protection Organization. So
okay.
I had two ministries.
Okay.
That so I had to deal with.
What was the second one?
Justice, I think it is.
Okay.
Justitie. Because the Ministry of Justice, they had to deal with these protection organizations, of course. And I was the only one in the whole province of North Holland as a student at that time. Later on, I heard that, of course, Mike. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
I was the only one under this problematic situation.
Mm-hmm.
I had to deal with the Ministry of Education and Science and the Ministry of Justice.
But
I did study, and that was okay. But then you had first your bachelor's degree.
Mm-hmm.
That was 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
A longer study than here in the United States.
Hmm.
The average length of a study until your master's degree was about 7.5 years. Mm-hmm. And again, I must say, it was a very good study. What I had at the gymnasium, the first 3 months, I didn't have to do much at the University of Amsterdam. I had it from the teachers Simons and Mensink. Mm-hmm. But you got a lot of physics and a lot of mathematics if you should start to do chemistry, yeah?
So did you decide when you started at the university that you wanted to pursue chemistry, or?
No, not in the beginning.
No.
That was a general education.
Okay.
And then later on you decided more to specialize.
Okay.
Yeah? But then in the Children of Protection Organization had still, of course, to do with me. Yeah, because I was not 21.
21 was the age of
yeah.
You could be.
And so I heard later on that the idea that I would finish an academic study coming from, yeah, a family, no academics, would he be able to, finish a study successfully?
Mm-hmm.
So therefore they said, we continue the rentloos voorschot.
Mm-hmm.
Every year you got there, yeah, at least my aunt and uncle.
Mm-hmm.
But they doubted whether I could make it. And then I did my bachelor's degree, cum laude.
Mm-hmm.
And cum laude is, yeah, I know in the United States you have summa cum laude, mm-hmm. but in the Netherlands cum laude is really good.
Mm-hmm.
So then they said, probably he will get it to his master's degree.
Mm-hmm. Of course, pretty soon you're going to be 21, so you don't have to deal with them
anymore. No, yeah. But then they decided, when I got my bachelor's degree, then I got rid of that. I got a grant, which I didn't have to pay back. That was nice, eh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I had another 3.5 years, and then I did my master's degree. In chemistry, but a specialization was physical organic chemistry. And that I can also explain why I made that choice. Because I had a very good professor in physical chemistry. His name was Gerrit-Jan Hoyting, G.J.
Mm-hmm.
And then Hoyting, H.O.I.G.
Mm-hmm.
T-I-N-K.
Mm-hmm.
He was editor also of Chemical Physical Letters, I think, that I didn't know at that time, yeah? And he was at the Free University originally, but he came to the University of Amsterdam, and when I followed his lectures in physical chemistry, then he explained bonding.
Mm.
So we got molecular orbital theory, atomic orbitals, combining to molecular orbitals, etc., etc. And these lectures were fascinating for me.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't have a syllabus, you know. Mm-hmm. Nowadays they say, well, he recommended these kind of books to buy, and
yeah.
I did that. But a syllabus, a written material, no. The professor gave his lectures. You made notes, because you could not know. And then I worked them out at home, and I still have them. But I thought, now I understand chemical bonding, I will do physical chemistry with Gerrit-Jan Hoyting as the main study, because you have to do that for almost 1 year. Eh?
Mm-hmm.
And but then he made a comment that theory is nice, but don't forget the experiment. Because he said, you now know from atomic orbitals that if you would have to predict which hydrocarbon is... the most simple one, and it is CH2,
mm-hmm.
with an angle of 90 degrees. But he then said, you know all, that we have methane, natural gas, from Groningen.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, that CH4 has four hydrogen atoms in an equal position around the carbon atom, with an angle of 109 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And so many, the details is not important, but a tetraeder, yeah? And he said then, nature doesn't know how to do that, but the human mind says to solve that problem, he said, and realize this is a human mind experiment, we mix now orbitals. we mix S orbital with P orbitals, and then we get SP3. You know, the 1s for down in carbon is the first, then the 2s, two electrons, and then the 2px, 2pi, 2pz. Mm-hmm. And then he said, realize, if you do that, this is an artificial thing which the human mind is doing to get, the problem solved. Because if you do that, then you get this tetraeder structure of methane. Mm-hmm. And then he said, so don't forget the experiment, but now the thing is, we cannot always get hold on the molecules we would like to study. They are not available. And then I thought, aha, so I have to mix physical chemistry with organic chemistry. Mm. Because then I'm able to synthesize compounds, and then I can do theory. That was the ideal, what I had in my head, yeah? Mm-hmm. So I decided to do physical organic chemistry for that reason. So I went to Professor De Boer. Mm. Yeah.
Professor.
It is like the, hey, de, D-E, and then Boer, B-O-A-R, E-R, Boer.
Okay.
He was the physical organic chemist at that time. Before there was another one, but Professor De Boer was at that time the physical organic chemist. So I went to him via the secretary, it was very official, Mike. It was Professor De Boer, hey? And you could not Mr. De Boer, no, Professor De Boer. And I learned when he retired then to say Tiemann, because that was his forename. But before that, mm-hmm. you could not say Tiemann, hey? It was mm-hmm. Professor De Boer all the time.
So, how do you spell it, first name?
T-H-Y, then the M-E-N. Tiemann De Boer.
Okay.
So he said, okay, next week you come back, and then you will get a project, because I asked for a project which will be a combination of theory and experiment. Mm-hmm. That's understandable from the story.
Yeah.
And you had to show up at 10:30 on Monday via the secretary, and I came in his room, and then he gave me the project of 1-nitropropane to show that the molecular ion of that compound, I didn't know what a molecular ion was at that time, underwent the McLafferty rearrangement, because that had been shown for carbonyl compounds, aldehyde, ketones, acids, esters, but not for nitro groups. And he was a nitro specialist. And you know, an NO2 group is isoelectronic with a carboxylic group. Mm. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So that was one thing. So I had to learn about mass spectrometry myself. And he said the way is to put labels in it, deuterium labeling, so you label the 1-nitropropane specifically in the alpha position, in the beta position, in the gamma position, so you had to synthesize these compounds, and then do the mass spectrometry experiments. Mm-hmm. So then I started my master's degree study, hey? That means that is for your specialization, 1 year, mm-hmm. yeah? So I made these compounds and measured them with a single focusing AEI MS2 H mass spectrometer. AEI is from Associated Electrical Industries, you know that I think. Mm-hmm. And MS2H, that had a heated inlet system, but single focusing, only a magnet. Mm-hmm. And it took of course some effort to get these labeled compounds, because he also had said to me, you are not allowed to use more than 30 guilders of D2O. Yeah, so the amount of D2O was worse than 30 guilders, and that was not much.
So G-U-I-L-D-E-R-S, guilders?
Guilders, yeah. And a guilder, nowadays, if you say a euro is actually 2.2 guilders.
Okay.
So you see 30 guilders was less than 15 euro.
Yeah, yeah.
And a dollar at that time was, of course, around more than 3.5 guilders.
Yeah.
Yeah?
So he was kind of tight with the money.
Yeah, it was tight with the money. Yeah, but you can understand that, I think, that also. Because 56 was 11 years after the Second World War. So, you know, the labs were not... I mean, the MS2H, that was an expensive equipment for a lab of organic chemistry. Yeah? Yeah?
So what could you buy with that? A couple hundred milliliters? Or
I don't remember anymore. No, not much. Because I have to practice the synthesis.
Yeah.
Because especially if you have to make... CD3, CH2, CH2, NO2, then you have to start, for example, with a CD3 iodine, yeah, and then try to extend the chain, and in the end, you get a CD3, CH2, CH2 iodine, and then make the nitro compound. Mm-hmm. And you know, at every step, you lose.
Oh, yeah.
So you have to practice with unlabeled compounds, and then purify by simple GC. And then, if you have done it so many times, then you thought, well, now I can do it with a labeled compound. And I can say to you, then at the critical experiment, you lost a lot, so the yield was lower, etc. So that, okay, but in the end, I made it. And Professor de Boer was a man who simply said to a student, so, go on. Sometimes you did see him, but he didn't ask so much because... My supervisor was in the end Professor de Boer, but I had Henk Hofman. He was at that time the head of the mass spectrometry division.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Henk Hofman.
H-E-N-K.
H-E-N-K is the forename, and then Hofman, H-O-F-M-A-N.
Mm-hmm.
He was running the mass spectrometry division of the spectrometry department, because we had also NMR, the HR60 from Varian. You had ultraviolet equipment, you had infrared.
Mm-hmm.
And then Piet van der Haak is the name which I would like to mention, who was head of the whole department for spectrometry.
PIT.
Van der, V-A-N, and then DER, D-E-R, and then Haak. Not all together, but Piet, space, van, space, der, space, Haak.
Oké, okay, H.
Piet van der Haak. H-A-A-K.
H-A-K.
Ja, H-A-A-K.
A-A-K.
Okay. Ja?
Piet van der Haak.
Van der Haak.
Oké, okay, Haak. So he was kind of like the head cheese of the analytical...
Yeah, you could... We didn't call it an analytical. It was the spectrometry division of the organic chemistry lab. But then I remember that I went through the corridor and did see Professor de Boer said, Professor, it is true, the McLaughlin arrangement is there. It's proven by the tearing labeling. But listen, there are more things. And so we wrote a paper on that. There were indeed more observations, interesting observations. For example, I had seen there also in that experiment the loss of an OH radical from the molecular ion.
Mm-hmm.
And that OH radical contained a hydrogen atom from the methyl group.
Mm-hmm.
So you had the molecular ion was at 89, very weak with electron ionization. They call it then electron impact, but now electron ionization is the right word. And then you had a peak at mass 72. And then we could show that was the due to the loss of OH containing the methyl hydrogen from the labeling.
Mm-hmm.
And then in addition to that, we had a stepwise scheme. So hydrogen atom transfer from the methyl group to the oxygen atom of the nitro group. And then there was either the root OH loss or ethylene loss. And the ethylene loss was the McLaughlin rearrangement.
Mm-hmm.
But we did show it stepwise because of the fact that we did see OH methyl hydrogen containing loss.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
As an organic chemist, I must say, Mike, because in mass spectrometry there was a lot of discussion whether reactions were stepwise or concerted. And I didn't have a problem because in the organic chemistry lectures it was very common that a reaction occurred in a stepwise fashion.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Concert was actually a little bit more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we published that. Oh yeah, I must also say, after the OH gamma, if I call it a gamma loss, mm-hmm. then there was a loss of water. And if you can, you are a chemist from origin or not?
Not really.
No, okay. But you end up with a CH2NO, mm-hmm. if you lose OH.
Okay.
You have a radical position at the end, terminal CH2 group, and a radical position on the nitrogen.
Mm-hmm.
And as an organic chemist, you immediately think biradical, mm-hmm. so close.
Well, yeah.
No. That experiment, the labeling, said, after the loss of OH, you had loss of water that contained only the hydrogen atoms next to the nitrogen.
Mm.
Hmm. So that said, no ring closure.
Hmm.
And at that time we could not study it further, but simply we wrote the paper in the Recueil des Travaux Chimiques des Pays-Bas. That is a journal, well, you have the publication list, so you will find it.
Okay.
Recueil des Travaux Chimiques des Pays-Bas. It's the first one, I think.
It just says the abbreviated...
Rec, Traf, Chim,
Pays-Bas. Yeah,
yeah, okay. Yeah. The foreigners always said the records of the traveling chemist. But then, I wanted to go into industry after my master degree. My master degree was also cum laude. So that went all well. But then, Professor De Boer said to me, you can go up for a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
Now, yeah, you know, I thought, yeah, if the professor is saying that I can do a PhD, why not?
Mm-hmm.
And so I started to do my PhD. He said, well, if you put some phenyl groups or aromatic rings in the chain, then alkyl nitro compounds. He said, you can make a thesis then out of it. So I started with that. And the idea was labeling. But then we caught hold of an AIMS-902 mass spectrometer. There was a new instrument in the lab. So you could do high resolution measurements. You could more easily observe metastable ions. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So I worked for my thesis on that subject. Making, of course, also the labeling compounds. But all the intermediate compounds which were made to make the nitro compounds, I also took the mass spectra. And I remember also that Professor De Boer, he was not always checking how you did, but if he came along, then he said, oh, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm now looking at the phenyl ethyl alcohol, for example. And he said, but we didn't agree on that to do that. I said, yeah. Then I said, yeah, Professor, but I have now the labeled compounds, and these have not been studied before, so... And then he went away. You know? So, I think he was like Van Oorle, the headmaster. He looked at the students, and then knew, oh, we will make it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Because when he was had retired, I said to Tiemann, I couldn't say Tiemann, you were a little bit, loose with the PhD student, like you didn't coach them so, eh? Yeah, he said, my attitude was you throw them in the middle of the ocean, and if they can swim, they will reach the beach, and if not, sorry for them.
Okay.
But I must say that all his PhD students did very well.
Yeah.
Yeah?
They learned how to swim.
They learned how to swim. But then, so I worked for my thesis, and then my predecessor, Henk Hofman, mentioned earlier, he finished his PhD, and he left the university and joined Unilever in Rotterdam.
Mm-hmm.
So, there was a vacant position. But I had in mind, I go to industry. And I had, in the midst of my PhD, discussions with the Royal Shell Lab in Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm.
Royal Dutch Shell Lab is the official name, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And with Philips in Eindhoven. And these interviews were really, very well. I mean, it was a pleasure to to talk there with the people. And they said to me, oh, you are on your PhD and you are, well, so much time you still have to do. Give a sign when you are 1 year before, because they would like to have me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And if I would have made a decision at that time, then I would have chosen for Philips.
Mm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
But they were almost equal, Shell and Philips.
Mm-hmm.
But when my predecessor left, then two permanent staff members tried to convince me that I should apply for that vacant position for the mass spectrometer division.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Mike, stubborn as I am, no, I go in industry. No, I go in industry. In the end, it was Piet van der Haak, one of them, who said that I should apply. And another one was Jaak Dirks, so they both were working on me. And in the end I said, okay, I will go to Professor De Boer and Professor Huisman. Professor Huisman was the synthetic organic chemist.
Mm-hmm.
And Professor De Boer, physical organic chemist.
Mm-hmm.
And they interchanged their position every 2 years. So De Boer was, for example, at that time adjunct. Yeah?
Adjunct.
Director. And then Huisman was the director. And then 2 years later they interchanged.
Mm-hmm.
So I came in the room of Professor Huisman.
H-U-I-S-M-A-N,
Huisman.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Henk Huisman. Hey? So, Henk Huisman, his forename Henk.
H-E-N-K.
H-E-N-K, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I came in the room of Henk Huisman, where Professor De Boer was also. The physical organic chemist.
Yeah, we have his name.
Yeah, okay. Because, yeah. So they were happy that I came. I could notice that. And so we had an interview about how did I see the future for mass spectrometry? How would I operate? And because you had to do analysis for the organic chemists. They made organic compounds and you had to check that with mass spectrometry. And then I said in a very natural way, because it was not really planned by me, but a natural reaction. I said, yeah, to do high qualified analysis, I think we should do research also.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what do you mean? I said, well, to do research means that I need then a group of, let's say, 3 PhD students.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I myself had to still to receive my PhD.
Yeah, yeah.
And they said, oh, that can be arranged.
Mm.
It's as simple as that.
Mm.
So in that way, I became head of the mass spectrometry division. Had to work on my PhD, and then soon after I start to coach PhD students.
Uh-huh.
But for a PhD, there was 4 years.
Uh-huh.
So Professor De Boer came in sometimes and he said, how are you doing, Mr. Ribbering? And I said to him, well, Professor, I'm not doing so much. What do you mean? I said, well, I'm working, of course, in daytime on the analysis of organic compounds, and to interpret spectra. And I said, but on my thesis, I can only work in the evening and the weekends. Oh, he said, it's a question of find the right balance. And then he went.
Really helpful.
Yeah, but I don't want to give an impression that De Boer was a bad professor. On the contrary, he was an extremely good professor. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And so I made my thesis instead of 4 years, 4.5 years. Well, that was reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got a Shell for my master's degree I got a Unilever Chemistry Prize. That is written down in my curriculum vitae. And for the PhD thesis, the Shell Research Prize. Then, of course, Mike, you can imagine, because I never postdoced.
Mm.
You understand now why?
Mm-hmm.
Because I was head of the mass spectrometer division, so you could not go for a year away.
Yeah. So, right, you had to go to work right away.
Yeah. But the Shell Research Prize, that was a very important prize.
For prizes, was there a financial came with them? So.
Yeah.
So it was more than just a recognition.
No, it was really money added to that. And They said, I think it was a prize which allowed you to be for 3 weeks in the United States.
Oh, okay.
If you would take, good accommodation, according to Shell standards.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I said to my wife, we were married in 64, I said to her, you could also make a choice for Europe. And I said, yeah, Europe you can always do by car.
Mm-hmm.
How many times will we cross the ocean
mm-hmm.
at that time?
Mm-hmm.
Rarely, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? But we made, instead of 3 weeks, 9 weeks out of it,
mm-hmm.
because we stayed overnight in very simple motels.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for American standard, it was really simple, and for us it was very luxury. And that trip is completely, I don't know how my mind is working, but I can reproduce that all the time, completely what happened. Eh? So the first was of course a long flight, and the first man I had chosen from the literature, of course, the colleagues working in mass spectrometry in the United States and in Europe, I mean, yeah, I started to be interested, etc. So I made a list whom I would like to visit. And that list was handed over to Professor de Boer. That Professor de Boer sent it over to Shell. And the Shell was not controlling to whom I went. They were not saying, you have to go
mm-hmm.
to that. That was my decision. That
right.
was the prize.
Mm-hmm.
But they wanted to know.
Mm-hmm.
And if they then did see, he is visiting him in the neighborhood was somebody else, they said, oh, perhaps you could also visit.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, the first man was Frank Field.
Oh, wow.
And so Linden, New Jersey.
Oh, sure.
Where he had his camera organization mass spectrometer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know that Frank Field passed away recently.
Mm-hmm.
It was a gentleman. We had a very good time. And but then Shell said, if you are in Esso Linden, New Jersey, then also Graham Wandless, because he did field ionization.
Graham
Wandless, W-A-N-L-A-S-E-S-S, Wandless.
Ah, okay.
He was the physical field ionization man.
Yeah. But neither of these people knew you from anybody.
No, I picked them up from the literature because
but they didn't know you.
No. No, Fred McLafferty knew me.
Okay, but Frank Field didn't, did he?
No, because in 67, that was the first time that I went to a triennial meeting, and it was held in Berlin, organized by Hans Beckeye. Then I met, of course, American. Americans, I think that Frank was there, but you know, as a PhD student in 67,
mm-hmm.
at the triennial meeting in Berlin, then I met, of course, these people, but you can also imagine, do you learn to know these people more or less? That is also, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
But it was a memorable meeting in Berlin, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
First, Professor de Boer accompanied me, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
My wife joined me in
this
that trip.
1967. Okay.
Before that time, I had met Gerashi Dudley Williams at a meeting in Oxford.
Okay.
But it was a local meeting.
Mm-hmm.
But in Berlin, that was the International Mass Spectrometry Conference, the third one. Now, the next year, there will be the 20th
mm-hmm.
International Mass Spectrometry Conference in Geneva.
Mm-hmm.
And last October, we had the 90th International Mass Spectrometry Conference in Kyoto,
mm-hmm.
Japan. But I have always attended these International Mass Spectrometry Conference.
Mm-hmm.
Now it is going on in a scheme every 2 years, but until now it was every three years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I've met, of course, a scientist, but the ones who I visited in 69, they were not all there
mm-hmm.
in Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't know me then, of course, and I only knew them from the literature. By the way, when I presented part of my PhD work in Berlin, then the night before I had ear problems, very painful. As a child, I had also their problems. So I know that my wife said there was a medical a congress from medical people, and in that hotel a medical person has been to look at my ears, and the next day I was more or less a little bit deaf.
Mm-hmm.
And the boer was, even the professor the boer was, yeah, a little bit concerned whether I could present the lecture. Mm. And I said, oh, there's no problem, of course. But he said, you should instruct the chairman, and that was Klaus Biemann.
Oh, okay.
And he said, you should instruct the chairman that you are not hearing so well if they pose questions. Mm-hmm. Now, okay. So I presented the lecture there. And it was on gamma phenyl, propyl, bromide and alcohol. And we had seen some funny exchanges between the side chain in the ring and the molecular ions. And then after the lecture, the first man who stand up was Fred. And he started to congratulate me. And I didn't understand, of course, what he meant. Yeah, he said that I had proven that he didn't name the McLaughlin, but that he pointed out the gamma hydrogen, mm-hmm. that I had proven that it was stepwise because of the exchange. Mm-hmm. And he asked me whether I agreed with that, and I said, yeah, but I have a better example. Stubborn again. One nitro propane.
Uh-huh.
From my master degree study. Uh-huh. Well, he didn't agree. And then Gerassi, Seibel, Williams, they all were asking me questions. I'm not doing this because I'm so good, Mike. No. I liked it, of course, and in a natural way I tried to, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so the boer was impressed.
Mm-hmm.
So then he said to me, because it was in 67, now you can finish now your PhD.
Mm-hmm.
And believe me, I said, professor, no, because that and this and that should be done, and then it is ready.
Mm-hmm.
Now I would say, no, I've never been a person like in a calculating, eh?
Mm-hmm.
No. But stubborn, hè? Say no, then it is ready, instead of saying, yeah, the other way around.
Yeah.
But then, coming back to the trip through the United States, so after Frank Field and having spoken with Graham Wonders, then we went to Ed Thornton in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
That was important, Mike, because there we did see the first big instrument in a flat, it was a big instrument, yeah, where the ion beam was deflected in the horizontal plane. I think it was the RMUHU, double focusing mass spectrometer. I think you can, I have to look it up. You remember perhaps. It was a Japanese machine.
From
JOL.
JOL.
Yeah. So that was an important thing. And
what lab was that in?
That was in Philadelphia with Ed Thornton. Ed Thornton.
Ed
Thornton. Ed Thornton. THORNTON. Thornton.
Okay.
I think Michael Kroos has been postdoc for some time with Ed Thornton.
Oh, okay.
Physical organic chemist.
Okay. And he was at what school?
Or Philadelphia, the University of Philadelphia.
University of Pennsylvania?
Pennsylvania, yeah.
Okay.
In Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And then I went to Morris Bursey.
Okay.
At that time in North Carolina, Chapel Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And he had just finished his postdoc, I think, or was already more than a year in Chapel Hill, but he worked also with Fred McLaughlin, so we knew Fred McLaughlin very well. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And there I did see a drift cell ion cyclotron resonance mass spectrometer from Varian.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And then I became excited because there I found out, of course, ion molecule reactions in the gas phase.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So Morris told what they were doing, and I thought, this is interesting, so you can study reactions of ions with molecules without solvents.
Mm.
And that is important for physical organic chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So that was very inspiring and motivating. And later on, of course, I heard that Jack Beauchamp had these kind of machines. And yeah?
Mm.
And we visited the Research Triangle Institute in Durham. I think, that was near to Chapel Hill, mm-hmm. with a man named David Rosenthal.
No, I remember David.
You remember him?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was also very stimulating. And from there, I went to Bob Kaiser in Lexington, Kentucky.
Oh, yeah, Bob.
And that was they were all nice, the colleagues. But Bob Kaiser was certainly a very friendly person. Mm-hmm. And he was working on scanning electric sectors and magnetic field scans. I remember that, computerized. Mm-hmm. Then I will say after the tour, what I did in Amsterdam, of course. But I had a good time. And from there, I went to Cy Meyerson.
Mm, sure.
At the American Standard Oil Company.
Uh-huh.
And Cy had been in, later on, Cy had been also in Amsterdam. But that was the first time that I met Cy Meyerson. Mm-hmm. In the lab, and you know, why was Cy on the list? Because of the tropium ion.
Mm-hmm.
Simple as that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Sure.
And then I visited also Bill Perkel in Urbana.
Bill?
Perkel.
P-I-R-K-L-E.
Bill Perkel.
Okay.
In Urbana, Campaign, I think,
yeah.
Illinois. Because he was an organic chemist. Doing mass spectrometry, but also NMR, as far as I remember, these were also chiral compounds.
Ah, okay.
An organic chemist is, of course, attracted by these kind of things. Mm-hmm. And from there, I went to Thomas Kinsel in Iowa. Ames, Iowa. Thomas Kinsel. K-I-N-S-T-E-L-A. It is also in the mass spectrometry review paper I wrote, so you can find it there. And Thomas, the trip was organized by American Express in Amsterdam, and I gave all these addresses where I had to go, and also at many, at least one lecture, but at some places sometimes three lectures. So they said at the American Express office in Amsterdam, listen, the program is too overloaded. You should also take time for yourself.
Yeah.
But okay, Thomas Kinsel, and from there we went to Peter Brown in Phoenix, Arizona. But then we flew to Denver. I didn't know at that time Chuck DePue or Ronnie Bierbaum. Mm. But we rented a car. It was simple, Mike. At that time in the United States, you came with your ticket. You said, yeah, I would like to change the ticket. Can I give it in and rent a car? Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Do it.
Yeah.
And we drove then from Denver to Phoenix.
Uh-huh.
So we did see Arches National Monument.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
The Gooseneck.
Mm-hmm.
It was a nice trip.
Oh, yeah.
And... Now let me also mention a story in that 1 week that we were tourists. So we went to Arches National Monument. It was the end of May, nice weather, but there were not many visitors.
Mm.
And so I had a car with a plate from Holland, but that was Michigan. No, Oregon. Oregon.
Oregon.
No, the Holland, Michigan will come in. So Oregon. And so the car was parked there, and then a couple from L.A., Los Angeles, was there, we found out, because they said, hi, you're far away from Oregon. I said, no, we are from Holland. Ah, Holland, Michigan. No, I said, Holland, the Netherlands. Oh, then we started to talk, and that couple living in Los Angeles, they said, yeah, we know a man in the Netherlands, etc., as if I would know all the Dutch. But he said, he never replies anymore. And I said, yeah, I was interested in motorbikes. And I said, oh, that is Jacques Brandsen. Believe me, really. They said, yes. Jacques Brandsen was a man, he did business, but he was collecting racing bikes, racing motorbikes. And he lived in Blaricum, in North Holland, but moved to Wessaan.
Mm.
And so I said to that couple of LA, sorry, that is Jacques Bransen. He changed address. So you could see we were one of the 12 million people, I think, from the Netherlands. They were 2 of 10 million, I think, was then in Los Angeles. You meet each other unplanned in Les Arcs, in the Les Arcs park. And then you come to these kind of discussions.
So how do you spell this guy? Is it Jacques?
Jacques Bransen, yeah. J-A-C-Q-U-A-S. French, eh? Jacques. Bransen. B-R-A-N-S-E.
Okay.
Jacques Bransen. And, well, he passed away many years ago.
But basically, they'd have been writing to this fellow and gotten no response.
No reply, no.
And so now they were able to tell him his new
because, yeah, because of the motorbikes, because I have always driven motorbikes, and we were especially interested in racing bikes. So I still have one, a 350 cubic centimeter Norton Manx in a featherbed frame at home. But that's another story, of course.
Yeah, that it is. Especially when you get it out and your wife sees you run it.
No, we went on holidays with a racing bike. Yeah, now you cannot do it anymore. But okay, so that was
That's
the...
Interesting, yeah. What a coincidence.
Yeah, a coincidence, yes. And so we went to Peter Brown in Phoenix, Arizona. And well, he was an organic chemist, but also a fan of fast cars. So that clicked immediately. Yeah. And from there, we went to UCLA to see David Leitner, who was a former PhD student of Carl Gerassi.
David
Leitner.
L.
L-I Leitner, hey? So it is Leitner.
Okay, got it.
Leitner, yeah? But also Saul Weinstein. Saul Weinstein.
W-E-I-N-S-T-I-N.
Yeah, you know, the well-known physical organic chemist.
Okay.
Because why? Saul had been in Amsterdam to talk about his work on homotropylium ions.
Oh, homotropylium.
Yeah. You know, a CH2 group in addition to the 7 CH groups.
Okay.
So it's a flat ring with the CH2 group is a little bit out of plane. So you keep the aromaticity. And so we presented that in Amsterdam, and then I had questions about it, and I said, working in on my thesis, that was during my thesis time that he was in Amsterdam, so I said, I think we have also evidence for the homotropylium ion based on the labeling work. And so therefore I decided to visit him, of course. And I didn't write it down in the mass spectrometry review article, but Saul said to me, why don't you come over to UCLA? But I didn't do that, because you know now, if you become head of the department or division of mass spectrometry during your PhD, you get also the PhD students to build up your group and to make also the vision of mass spectrometry more blossoming. You don't want to change job. I mean, nowadays you will think in another way.
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay, so that from then, from UCLA, we went to Carl Gerassi. That was, of course, also logical. Carl Gerassi I have met in Berlin. You can also find that in the mass spectrometer review article that I had to present my lecture in the evening. One of his co-workers was Alan Duffield from Australia. He distributed, before I gave the lecture there, spectra to his students and PhD students, three. And he said, I distributed these with following request. Not now to do it, but look at the spectra, try to interpret it, then write down how long it did take, and why you came to that conclusion, etc. And then he said, you have the word, and I said to Professor Gerassi, can I also participate in that? Can I get a couple of spectra? Yeah, take it with you, I will report when I'm back in Europe. Okay. And why, of course, interpretation of mass spectra? You can now guess why. I mean, working in an organic chemistry lab where you had to do the analysis, the mass spec, the organic chemist wanted to know whether not only the molecular weight, but also sometimes, I must say organic chemist, most of the time they said, if the molecular weight is okay, then it's okay.
Yeah.
But if they would like to have, want to know more, then you have to do the interpretation. Mm-hmm. And if NMR cannot solve it, there was a funny contradiction in their reasoning. They liked NMR. Mm-hmm. It was much simpler.
Yeah.
Mass spectrometry was very complicated. But if NMR could not solve it, then they came to mass spec and they thought that mass spec could solve them their problems. Whereas it was so difficult.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that was a good training for me all the time
mm-hmm.
to learn about fragmentation
mm-hmm.
and to do research in that field also. So I came back later on in Europe and I did the interpretation. In half an hour I managed to get proposals for the structures and I send them back to Gerassi, and later on there was a paper from Carl Gerassi and Joshua Lederberg from Stanford University
mm-hmm.
and there I found out that the compounds he had given the elemental composition so that one oxygen atom and one you could figure out there was one double bond.
Mm-hmm.
So that made already a selection in your mind.
Sure.
But the number of possibilities was more than 3,300. Over that. So, how is the human mind working? So I had a colleague in the lab was doing software development, Chris Kort. And he was really good in mathematics.
Chris
Kort. C-H... R-I-S
mm-hmm.
and then family name K-O-R-T Chris Kort
mm-hmm.
I said to Chris because I thought it was artificial intelligence mm-hmm. at that time and I think they have published around 6 or 8 papers and I thought oh that's very interesting because if you can do it by computer
mm-hmm.
that would be nice at that time mm-hmm. So I said to Chris would be nice if you could make a program, hey? And he said, okay, if you tell me how you do the interpretation, there the problem started.
Uh-huh.
Because I said to Chris, you look at the spectra and the number of bits which is going through your eyes is so large, so you immediately mentally say, oh no, that is not yeah. Mm-hmm. So it is already narrowing down, hey?
Yeah.
And I said to him, there are many roads to get to Rome. That means you get so many ways to interpret. He said, if you say that, then I cannot make a program. Now, from Carl Gerassi, then I went to the Bay Area. It was in the Bay Area. Now, let's say Stanford is a little bit outside the Bay Area. But then to Al Burlingame in Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And he was heavily involved the day when I visited him. Because that was working on the NASA project, the first moon landing.
Oh, boy.
So he was all the time in discussion with Houston, because they had to collect rocks,
mm-hmm.
and he was all the time apologizing. I met him now recently, last year in Kyoto, that's recently. So it was nice to see him again, but he was coming along and apologizing, no, you'll actually, I will be there, but... and he said, okay. I got a nice picture of the Earth from the space, so I still did it at home. And so he was at the lecture. And then I also visited Phil Wadsworth from Shell in Emeryville.
Mm.
Because now you see, Shell knew the people that I visited. So they said, why not Phil visiting Phil Wadsworth? Mm. Also a very pleasant visit. And then we crossed the United States to go to Fred McLaughlin in Ithaca.
Mm-hmm.
And Fred wanted to have me as a postdoc, of course.
No, oh, okay, sure.
But that is impossible. Was impossible, of course.
Yeah.
Later on, I've been in Fred McLaughlin's lab, but that was for other reasons. So I've been there for a few months working. Well, let me first finish the trip to through the United States, of course. So after having visited Fred, then the last man was Alex Harrison in Toronto.
Okay, I'm not familiar with that gentleman.
Alex.
Oh, Harrison?
Yeah, Harrison, oh, you know.
Yeah, the CIA, chemical ionization.
He is doing, he did tropium ions also and thermochemistry, and he is now more on, let's say, iron from amino acids and peptides. He changed, but he's a physical chemist, and it was a very good colleague also of Keith Jennings, because Alex had spent also some time with Keith at Warwick University. And then back home. Now,
Basically, they left. It was your discretion how to spend the money. So, if you could stretch it out for, you know,
9 weeks instead of 3 weeks,
then they didn't care.
They didn't know about the time schedule.
Oh,
they knew about the people that
couldn't they figure out that you were.
No, I had a mentor at Shell. That was Dr. Engelhardt. Dr. Engelhardt.
E-N-G-E-L-H-A-R-D,
and I think a T at the end. Okay. It is in the Dutch language, you have many names that derive also from German origin. And he was at Rijswijk, Shell Rijswijk, not in Amsterdam, but in Shell Rijswijk. That is the exploration lab.
R-I-G,
you know, the strange I. S-W-E-J-I-G, yeah, K.
Okay.
Rijswijk, the funny Y, yeah.
Okay.
And that's the exploration lab of the Shell company.
Ah, okay. So he had some idea of what you were going to be doing.
Yeah. So I had to write a report, of course.
Sure.
Yeah. Now, that was very exciting. I have it somewhere at home. I keep too many things, but there are also too many things. So I know in which direction I more or less have to look at where it is. But I have, at least I think, still a good memory. I remember that I wrote that what I have seen during the trip was the Drexel ICR. I thought this was really a very good method to have for physical organic chemistry, because I expected there a lot of results which will be of interest to the organic chemist. And therefore, I wrote a proposal for the Dutch National Science Foundation, the chemistry division, but I could not submit it. It always went through the professor. That was the rule. So Professor De Boer, he looked at my proposal and then might have changed some Dutch, etc. But he was in the organization of the Dutch National Science Organization. Actually, it was called ZWO, that means Pure Scientific Research. ZWO.
Ah, okay.
And that was Pure Scientific Research. Now it is NWO, the Netherlands Science Research. Netherlands Science Research Organization. Organization.
Okay.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And that holds also for the Pure Scientific Research Organization. He came back, I remember, in my office then, and he said, congratulations, because I got, 250,000 guilders, that means it was a quarter of a million guilders.
Whoa.
To buy the Varian Cyrotron. Drexel ion cyclotron, resonance mass spectrometer. It is, I think, V903 was the Varian V903 Cyrotron.
What do they call it? S-Y-R-O
Cyrotron. Yes, Cyrotron. Cyrotron.
Okay, they make a fancy name out of it.
Yeah. But it was a Drexel ion cyclotron resonance mass spectrometer with an ion pump, ion gathering. I got that money, so I could order that machine. Oh yeah, what the boer also said to me, congratulations, and we expect of course many results. And then he went again.
Yeah, right. Get to work.
But yeah, I wanted also to do it. Because since that trip, I read all the literature from Drexel ICR that you could do it at that time.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And I made not a syllabus for teaching, But when we started to do research, if students came in, I gave them that booklet, which was printed. Mm-hmm. Perhaps I should have written made a book out of it, an official book.
Yeah.
Nah, yeah, okay, I didn't do that. So we had always a good start, and it was also a good entry to come up with a research project.
Sure,
because
yeah.
you could say, ah, they said that in the literature, well, perhaps it is different.
So probably at that time there weren't more than, what, a dozen papers that were a dozen researchers?
Yeah. Not many. Jack Beauchamp, of course.
Yeah.
Carl Girashi had one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, but it took a long time to get it installed. Why? We had a problem with the electricity that was found out. It was unstable. And later, so they sent over technicians, but they could not solve the problem. And in the end, they sent somebody who was well experienced from Verian, California, and, to Amsterdam. It was in Palo Alto, of course. And he managed to do it, but he found out the electrical environment was very polluted. A lot of noise and, well, so we had to stabilize it. Mm-hmm. And then it started to work. But in the meantime, the thing was, of course, pumping all the time. And I tried to do experiments to learn to work with the equipment and how that worked. And the iron getter pump, in the end, didn't do it anymore. And but the instrument was not fully paid because I waited until it was approved. That is the normal way.
Yeah.
And then they said, but you have worked at too high pressures.
Mm-hmm.
Well, 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 8. I said, listen, it is an instrument which was designed to do iron molecule chemistry. So you do it at a higher pressure. So if you decide to have an iron getter pump, then perhaps that is not a good idea. Yeah? So in the end, they adopted my arguments because I said, listen, there will be a meeting on ICR in the lab of Keith Jennings. That was the other one in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And there will be a meeting. And I will not keep my mouth, of course. I mean, why should I? And then I got a new iron getter pump, and then it was okay.
Mm-hmm.
And later on we changed it, and that is on one of the pictures you can see, we have a mercury pump added to it, you know, to get rid of the,
Yeah, well, it kind of, like you said, it's a silly idea if you're going to work at high pressure to put a getter pump on it.
I don't want to blame companies, I mean, they do their best also.
I wonder if it was Verian maybe in the iron getter pump business and they wanted to use them or something like that.
That is the thing, eh? Verian, I think, was more a company for NMR.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Yeah.
And if I can imagine if you, as a company, start in another field, you have knowledge there that you sometimes say, well, let us put in that because we know companies in that area. That can happen, of course.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, when I visited Bob Girashi, then I have also seen the. I spoke with Bob Finnegan then. He was working on the campus with Chu, I think, was his co-worker.
Chu.
Yeah. You know him because suspect that you know him.
Yeah.
That was also nice because they were working on the what was it? The quadrupoles, I think, isn't it?
Yeah,
Bob Finnegan.
Yeah, quadrupole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He had visited also me in Amsterdam later on,
uh-huh.
But it was nice because later on you could see Bob Finnegan, Finnegan Matt.
Yeah.
So you see that from the trip to the United States, it paid off very well. Scientifically, it was a very interesting trip, and it introduced me to Drifzel ICR.
So it was work both ways, I think, for people on both sides. And it was a very good use of this Shell Award.
Yeah.
Shell
Research Chemistry Prize.
Okay.
Shell, the Dutch Shell Research Prize.
Mm-hmm.
It is written down in the review again, because I'm precise what is written down, hey, so that I'm really telling you the truth. Exactly as possible.
Sure. So if you're Have you gotten your PhD by this time yet?
Yeah, my PhD was, because the trip to the United States was made after my PhD. PhD was done on the 2nd of October, if I'm right, I think that is right, in 68. Mm-hmm. Because I started on the 1st of April in 64.
Okay.
So it was a little bit longer than 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because the prize was awarded for the PhD thesis.
Right, okay.
You see?
Very good. Now, in the European tradition, they usually have this, at least in Germany, they had this period after PhD, if you went into an academic environment, you had this, I can't think of the name of it now in German. It's kind of like a...
Habilitation?
Yes.
We don't have that. We don't have that. Our older son is working in the Max Born Institute, and he decided to study at the Free University because he learned that when we were in Boulder, Colorado in 1980, that is a later period, of course, but then the American colleague said, if you go to a university, don't go to the university where your father is professor. Nou ja, the Netherlands is very small, you know.
Yeah.
So that, but he decided therefore, because we never coached the children what to do.
Mm-hmm.
I said, if they can find it out themselves, mm-hmm. why not?
Mm-hmm.
It's better.
Mm-hmm.
Like perhaps like the boer. Hey?
Yeah, right. Same thing.
Same thing. Yeah, swim. But he decided to do chemistry at the Vrije Universiteit in Amsterdam, master degree, cum laude also, physical chemistry, cum laude. And he took additional physics. And then he went to Groningen to do laser work with Douwe Wiersma. Then he got his PhD there, also cum laude. I'm very proud of it. The colleagues are saying that he's doing extremely well. Then he went for 3 years to France to work with Mizirovic in Orsay. Most of the people say Orsay, but it's Orsay I learned from him.
Mm-hmm.
In a classified lab with very strong lasers, I think for military purposes. I've never been there because when we went to him, then we want to see him, and I thought, well, the lasers. And after 3 years, he went to Berlin and joined the Max Born Institute, where he is still working now there. Thomas Elsasser was then the director. He is there the group leader. And independent, contrary to Max Planck Institute, so he has his own funding, etc. And therefore I know that colleagues say he's doing extremely well.
Yeah.
But he did a habilitation also.
So he did in Germany?
In at the Freie Universiteit in Berlin.
Okay.
Because if you do that, Mike, then you can apply for professorships if there are vacant positions.
Okay.
But you know, and they can offer you, but you know, he is doing in Berlin, and Berlin is a very interesting city. He attracts a lot of people from outside all parts of the world. And if I say to you the University of Cottbus, then you will say, Cottbus, never heard of it. Because that's border Germany-Poland.
Mm-hmm.
It will not say that it must be a bad university, but it is not a university which will attract.
Mm-hmm.
So if our older son will change position, then it has to improve or get better. Yeah, then you can think about Munich, Hamburg. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
But okay, going back, because that is another story, of course.
So, but in the Netherlands, the habilitation is not...
No. But you know also now the reason why I didn't postdoc.
Mm-hmm. Sure, because you already had a job.
I in some way I regret it, because I have been later on many times in the United States, and also this week with Graham is a very motivating group.
Mm-hmm.
So I see also, it is always good to be in other labs,
mm-hmm.
and have communications with other groups, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
But I can also say to you, that there are three things in mass spectrometry which are important, in my opinion, and these are time independent. That is fundamental research, is one pillar.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is developing of instruments and new methodologies.
Mm-hmm.
That's the second, and the third one is applications. And it doesn't matter in which time you live.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
The subject changes, but yeah.
That's a good assessment.
Yeah.
And that's how progress is made.
Yeah.
So now you've had the opportunity to step right into academia without any further ado. Now, you have any teaching obligations in this?
Yeah, I have always taught spectrometry courses, but especially mass spectrometry. Mm-hmm. And I have done for a number of years, but not many years, first year organic chemistry. Well, I'm not saying that other people talk about me, whether I did it well, but I did it extremely well, they said. Now, yeah, okay, I have to believe. Mm-hmm. But why didn't I teach so much? Because I did run the mass spectrometry division for the organic chemists. That, of course, the interpretation, coaching the PhD students from other groups, mm-hmm. telling them about mass spectrometry. Mm-hmm. So they, Professor De Boer and Huisman, they regarded it also as teaching. Mm-hmm. It was also true. But also, Mike, I said to Tim and De Boer, at that time, of course, Professor De Boer, I didn't understand why you had these different labs, like a lab of organic chemistry, a lab of inorganic chemistry, a lab of physical chemistry, and analytical chemistry, biochemistry. That was, of course, of finances, that you have this organization. But I did run already very early in my career then, and you can see it from the publications, also for inorganic aluminium isopropoxide. Mm-hmm. Found out about not only a monomer, but there are dimers, trimer structure for, and also for chemical engineering. There was a group in chemical engineering, an official chair. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't see the borders between these labs from the mass spectrometry point of view. So it was applied in many other fields. Mm. That was the attractive thing also. Mm. Yeah?
Okay.
Yeah.
So you got had students as graduate students, and you also taught the classes to undergraduate students. So were these, now you talk about organic chemistry, typically in America those are large sections. Were these like, cases where you had 100 students or?
Oh, the first year organic chemistry was attended by 130 people.
Okay, so it's a typical organic chemistry where you've got a fairly
large. Nowadays it has gone very down, we understand that diminished that. But at that time 130 for the first year organic chemistry. And the mass spectrometry courses, they were more around 25-30 people.
Okay, but that's a pretty good size group for mass spec.
Yeah. And then also what we did, that was an we called it an, you could choose for it, you didn't have to do that for your study, but you could make a choice for it like I did during my study. I attended lectures in other fields from physics, simply because I did want to know it.
Sure.
But then advanced mass spectrometry. So you told about the new chemical instrumentation, other methods, but then also the interpretation of spectra without much additional information. So not NMR or infrared, but simply mass spec. Mm-hmm. And then
this has all been electron impact.
Also chemical ionization. Electron ionization, electron impact, as you call it, that was the biggest part of it, of course. Mm-hmm. Later on, it changed and the things were added. Of course, you had also electrospray and MALDI. Mm-hmm. But the trick was to get to a structure only based on the mass spectra. Mm. And what is the principle of interpretation? You say, it cannot be this because of that and that reason. It cannot be this because of that and that reason. And in the end you have say, because you excluded this and that and that and that in the end, so it must be that. Uh-huh. So, yeah?
So, was there much use made of database searching and library?
We had that. We used it at the division of mass spectrometry. That was a way. I also told them, because the McLafferty, the Wiley spectra, 250,000, which could be scanned in later on in parts of a second.
Yeah.
I said that was very handy for analytical purpose. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Because it saves time.
Right.
Simple as that. But I always said it's nice, but it is comparing stamps with stamps. Yeah?
Uh-huh.
Now, if it doesn't fit, uh-huh. if it is not in the database,
right.
then the man, the person in question will still ask you, do you have an ID?
Mm-hmm.
No, then the interpretation is coming in. So I think it is very important. I can assure you that with pharmacologists, we had a problem. Yeah, that was the nice thing about the application part. You had not only with chemists. Physicists came with the purity of their gases.
Uh-huh.
yeah? Then you had medical people also, because we have not spoken about developments of ionization methods also in Amsterdam, but we did run samples for hospitals in academic hospitals
uh-huh.
with field desorption.
Mm-hmm.
The eye disease, how do you call it, glaucoma.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? But there was a pharmacology group and, at the University of Amsterdam, and they had a compound which was isolated from wasps which were in Egypt, and these wasps had the capability to inject their prey with some liquid, and that paralyzed the prey, so they always had fresh food, yeah, because you didn't die.
So these you say wasps?
Yeah,
Wasps,
yeah, you know, these nasty, like bees, but it is wasp.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Wasp.
Well, yeah, I think wasp. Wasp must be. I took this with me because I thought I managed to speak English, but it is not always.
I think what you're referring to is what we would call is a wasp.
A wasp.
W-A-S-P.
Yeah, okay, that's it.
It's a flying bug.
Yeah, yeah, but in Dutch language it is a wasp. That's the confusion. And so they had to kill, I think, at least 2,000 wasps to get enough material. So they came to the mass spectrometry division, and then they said, could you analyze it? Yeah, okay. And then we took the mass spectrum, and I started to interpret, and I said, it seems as if these are phenol compounds. And you know, these guys said, oh yeah, that could well be. Everything was possible. But then, looking further, I said, how do you purify, how do you get the sample? And they used plastic tubes.
Mm-hmm.
Said, oh.
Okay.
So we have here phthalates, etc. Mm-hmm. Said, now you have to do it another way. So they had to repeat that experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had, in the end, enough compound to do an elemental composition, electroionization, field ionization. The molecular weight was 243. It had, I think, 8 or 9 carbon atoms, one nitrogen, and an oxygen. We found out it was an amide.
Hmm.
And then fully saturated alkane chain.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the interpretation of that spectrum, no NMR.
Yeah, yeah.
So by rigorously interpreting, as we did with the course, advanced course in interpretation, there was a student from Nico Speckamp, a synthetic organic chemistry colleague. So it took me an afternoon, and the student was there, so he could see how I did it. And in the end, I came up with 4 possibilities. It was an amide, where the chain length could be one carbon atom more, the other side, etc. And so they started to synthesize. It was not simple.
Mm.
Because to check the activity of that. And that synthesis was certainly not easy, as Nico Speckham, the colleague, said. But then the pharmacologist, he talked at a conference, and then Dow heard about that. And Dow said, oh, that is very interesting. And they offered to cooperate.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave also some funding. And in the end, it was solved.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, we had also enough sample to get an NMR spectrum. But my colleague Cor Kruk, who did NMR, I said to Cor, there is another thing about NMR. NMR is easy for organic chemists because they know what they are doing. But now if you get a sample from that origin, and you say to an NMR man, hey, can you solve the problem? It is not so easy.
Mm.
Then it's net as difficult as mass spec.
Mm-hmm.
But I gave him the molecular weight information and the structure we thought, so yeah. That helps. But I said in the end to Cor, it might well be that if they have managed to make that compound and they test it, it might well be that it is not as active as the natural isolated compound, because we could see there were impurities.
Ah, okay.
You know, the mixing of things can, yeah. And indeed, the activity was not as large as the natural one.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is, perhaps I didn't write that in the mass spectrometer review article, that particular paper, but okay, because I covered as much as I could. Mm-hmm. You cannot cover. But you see how it works, from having done organic chemistry, physical chemistry, interested in structures, why, and in a logical way, and that has been the basis to do cast phase ion chemistry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is unimolecular chemistry, of course. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Get your hands on fragmentations, yeah? And organic chemists, of course, they said, it's nice, but it's all high energy chemistry. It's nothing to do with.
Yeah.
And you know, what I always regretted, in the first year, they taught, of course, organic chemistry always in solvents.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remove solvents, then yeah, that it is not amazing that the chemistry is a little bit changing, isn't it?
No, yeah.
And is it, if you fire an electron of 70 electron volt on a molecule, organic chemists say, of course, 70 electron volt, that is a very strange unit.
Mm-hmm.
How many kcal is that? And you say, well, it's about 1500 kcal, or yeah, nothing will survive. So this is a ridiculous method. But then you say, yeah, but the electron is passing the molecule, so there is only part of the energy is transferred.
Yeah.
Yeah, but how much? Yeah, nou ja, then you say 3 to 5 electron volt. Eh? But that is still a lot of energy, although carbon-carbon bonds are 80 kcal per mole, so more than 3.5 electron volt. CH bonds are 4 electron volt.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, these guys don't think in these terms.
Yeah, yeah.
But I must say, after all the years of research in that field worldwide, by many other colleagues also in that field, fortunately, it has come down to, it is not high energy chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
There are rules behind that. Mm-hmm. But we all know chemistry is very complicated. If you take the four elements, carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, and oxygen,
mm-hmm.
or add a sulfur and a phosphor,
mm-hmm.
and then the number of possibilities of stable molecules,
mm-hmm.
Mike,
mm-hmm.
is terribly high.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Definitely.
That was exactly what the Boer always pointed out, with only this limited number of elements, that there are so many possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
So I always said, also in teaching mass spectrometry, realize how many possibilities there are, go to the Biostein in the lab. You see there these thick books on all these different compounds.
Mm-hmm.
So don't expect that mass spec is also so easy.
Yeah.
And that you, and then I said also to make program for the interpretation, like a database set, it's almost impossible. Nowadays I would say there is more computer facility, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But the variety in chemistry is so large.
Yes.
Hey?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So the your teaching has been pretty much a little bit on the light side compared to what a normal academic professor would teach, but
yeah.
you did have an obligation in teaching students in both undergraduate and in the graduate area.
Yeah.
And so, where do you then?
Yeah, I didn't regard it as an obligation. I mean,
okay, but I mean the school did, all right? I mean,
I must say the course, the first year organic chemistry, but that was to help a colleague.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I needed to replace somebody for some time because of, yeah.
Okay.
But no, because the Professor Huisman and Professor De Boer, they did see that I was very busy to coach the students in the sense that they had their problems and I had to tell,
mm-hmm.
because they could not do it. And then the courses in mass spectrometry was, of course, written on my life,
right.
So to speak.
Your graduate students, that how did they come to you? Either
they studied organic chemistry and we were in organic chemistry, of course.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And these people did, for example, in master degree studies and they got spectra from our division. I tried to explain.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we had a scheme in our lab. There were several professors, hey, that included synthetic, bio, and physical organic. We had a number of PhD positions funded by the university. And that was discussed in the so-called Committee for Scientific Research of the Lab of Organic Chemistry. So you knew how many PhD students you should have on a more or less equal partition. Mm-hmm. And so if I had an open position, then either you made an advancement, but many times you didn't have to do it.
Yeah.
Because there were master degree students in the group of De Boer, for example, physical organic chemistry, and then De Boer said, well, go to Nico Nibbering.
Yeah.
For example, later on I will mention Leo de Koning, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And Tiemann said, yeah, he didn't have a position for him.
Mm-hmm.
But he was not jealous of me, but he said, it's very good that you get him. He's a good student.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? But also from other labs, from the Vrije Universiteit, I got him.
Okay.
Because we did run also samples for other labs when they didn't have the sophisticated instrumentation, because we had double focusing, ICR, FT-ICR, and
so who paid for all that stuff?
Now, the thing is that I managed to get funding from the Dutch National Science Foundation for chemical research.
Okay.
So you apply there, you submitted a proposal for instrumentation together with the project. And that worked out. You are not easy. Perhaps that will can come later on. But I must say, I got always a good funding from the Dutch National Science Foundation.
So did you have only one source of funding this whole...
Yeah, you can now, let's say the MS2H was already there when I started. The MS9 I was not involved. The Varian MAT 711 was another double focusing instrument with a Mattau-Herzog geometry, because the MS9 was a Near Johnson geometry.
Mm-hmm.
You are familiar, I think, with the Near Johnson geometry.
Yeah.
And the Mattau-Herzog, you will have heard about that.
Yeah.
That Varian MAT 711 instrument, Mike, that came in the following way in our lab. Analytical chemistry and organic chemistry together, they wanted to have an additional instrument in addition to the AEI MS9, because the AEI MS9 was around 1966.
Mm-hmm.
And Professor Huber, J.F.K. Huber, H-U-B-E-R,
okay.
He was a well-known analytical chemist in GC.
Gas chromatography?
But later on in LC.
Okay.
He also gave lectures at Harvard University.
Mm-hmm.
He was from Vienna, came to the Netherlands, and via the University of Eindhoven, he joined the University of Amsterdam.
Okay.
Joseph was his full name. He wanted to have a GCMS instrument, and of course, I was the logical man to cooperate with him, and I have a very pleasant memory about Jozef. It clicked, if I say it in English.
Mm-hmm.
So we said, yes, a new instrument, and there were 200,000 guilders from organic, 200,000 from analytical, and 400,000 guilders were provided from a special fund from the faculty and also the higher level in the university, but I didn't know. I mean, I didn't know the details, because Professor Huisman, at that time the director of the Organic Chemistry Lab, he managed to get that money.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays, Huisman, I like the man. De Boer and Huisman, they were a little bit fighting with each other, not really, but I mean, yeah, their characters were a little bit different, yeah. Mm-hmm. But Huisman, he had very good contacts also in The Hague, in the governmental level. And so I remember that he said, it is arranged, you will get the instrument. And some of the people from the physical organic said, but has it been signed? Is there a contract? He said, no, it's not required.
Mm-hmm.
And it was true.
Mm.
Not required.
Wow.
That's in, and well, I will not go too far to outside the family, but Hans, our second son, is in financial business. Of course, he made contracts. Mm-hmm. But sometimes also that you say, we agree. We can trust each other. Right. Trust. Mm-hmm. Trust is the word. Mm-hmm. At that time, that could be done.
Yeah.
And so, with the 800,000 guilders, was almost a lot of money. Then we made trips to AEI, MUT, Fiji, to come to a conclusion what kind of instrument it should be. Mm-hmm. And in the end, we made the decision, the Varian MUT 711. The MUT Varian was, of course, the computer system, 620i, coupled.
When did you buy that?
69.
Oh, okay.
The Varian 620i computer. Data system, yeah. And Joseph Huber said to me, first you work with the instrument, and if you are satisfied with the setup and it is installed and you have experience enough, then we will try to do GCMS.
No, okay.
But before that time came, then he had changed his interest in LCMS.
Ah, yes, okay.
But this was a trip with him and Piet van der Haag, whom I mentioned before.
Yeah.
We went to Bremen, and there was also a technician with me, of course. But then there was still money left for the 800,000, eh? So we ordered electronization and the data system, etc. And then they said there is still 35,000 guilders left. And Joseph said, what do you want? I said, field ionization.
Okay.
That brought me in field ionization because I had read the papers of Hans Beckeye from the University of Bonn. Mm-hmm. And what did I learn about field ionization from him, from his work? There was no hydrogen scrambling. I hate the word scrambling, because it is as if it is not rational what is going on there. I mean, it turns off the organic chemist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I prefer to use the word randomization. That's a little bit friendlier. There's the same effect, of course, but that brought me into field ionization, and also with field ionization you could get molecular ions of compounds which were not seen upon electron ionization.
Yeah, right. Yeah? Exactly, sure.
Mm-hmm. But it took, how many years did it took? First, the installation of the machine took a lot of time. But before we got the field ionization source in our lab, that was in 74, not earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another story, perhaps, which is of interest. The beam was very unstable in the beginning of the Varian MUT machine.
Hmm.
So, a MUT I've always had with all the companies, by the way, with AI and VG and MUT, Varian MUT, always a very good relationship with the people there. Really, believe me, no problem. But they changed, of course, the boxes, the electronics, and see whether it was an electronic instability, yeah. And nothing helped. And then Karl-Heinz Maurer from the MUT Bremen company came over to Amsterdam. He was a very experienced man because, we would like to work with the instrument.
Yeah.
And he tried everything, and then it turned out that the beam became very stable.
Let's take a little time out here.
Yeah. No, I have to finish this.
Oh.
No. Just 1 second.
Okay, 1 second.
So I'm going to.
You know, so the instability of the ion beam, then he found out by working at night, and that continued until 1:15. And then the beam was very stable. And then he worked home, checked everything, and at 5:15 the beam became very unstable. And it turned out to be the trams in Amsterdam, the cause of the. Because the trams are running on, trams, you know, streetcars, eh? These are running on DC, direct current.
Mm-hmm.
And the only other place is Sao Paulo, where they also have direct current. Mm-hmm. And
that's pretty unusual.
Yeah, it's unusual. And they did measure, of course, they checked before installation of that instrument in the cellar down in the lab whether the environment was okay. Mm-hmm. But they did measure in the wrong frequency, I think, or something like that. And then they came up also with a solution. They sent over a certain name, I think. His name was Dr. König, mm-hmm. like King, eh? Mm-hmm. And he was a very silent scientist, but working, doing measurements. And he went back and they simulated the streetcar by putting wires in the gutter of the company to, simulate the magnetic field variations, because that was, of course, the cause.
Yeah, yeah.
Which we didn't see with the AIMS-9, because there the beam was selected, deflected in the vertical direction, so that it doesn't matter if you have that.
Yeah.
And then he said we should make a coil of 740 meter copper wire in a wooden frame. Wooden frame had to be made on site, and then at a certain point, the center had to be at the entrance of to the electric sector, and then a pickup coil at the ceiling. And that sensed the variation of a magnetic field and compensated for that. And then we had a very stable ion beam. Because the Earth magnetic field is 2 milligauss.
Yeah.
They're stable.
Yeah.
But this was compensated immediately. And they guaranteed, it is also Germanic, hey? You guarantee a high resolving power with a 10% value definition of 70,000.
Yeah.
But it was then 90,000.
So this guy made these measurements
in Bremen. Yeah, he made the measurements in the lab,
and then
went back to Bremen and simulated the tram by putting a wire, and then came with the solution. You should have a coil of 700.
This thing hanging.
It is on the slides. If you look later on, then you can find it, you can see it. And I mentioned it also in the mass spectrum review paper.
So the one coil
picks up the variation, the signal, and compensates immediately by making a current through the wire, through the coil. Yeah, because you know, we had heard about the story in Klaus Biemann's lab, where they also had these electrical problems, that you had to work with mu metal to avoid the magnetic field lines.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, that will become very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this was a nice solution.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah.
The guy must be a genius.
Yeah, it was a genius, yes. Herr König, yeah.
Ger?
König, yeah, Mr. König. König, yeah. That I remember the name König, yeah.
That's all okay.
Yeah, it's all what I know.
Pretty neat.
Yeah, it's neat.
That's amazing.
It's amazing, yes.
Really strange. Well, you know, I guess he knew his business.
Yeah.
So this was with the, was it the 741? No, it was with the ICR machine.
This was the Ferien Mat 711.
It was with the 711.
Yeah, the double focusing mass spectrometer with a Mattau-Herzog geometry.
Okay.
The drift cell ICR, there we had also electrical pollution, but that was another. There you work with oscillators, yeah?
Right, okay.
So there the pollution was such that we could not get good signals out of it.
Mm.
But that has also been solved.
Yeah.
But it's a typical pollution. Yeah, both are, of course, typical for Amsterdam, I would say.
All right, so you're able to get the money to buy this equipment.
Yeah.
And this is something that's going on through your whole career, though. I mean, this is...
Yeah, because, AIMS 902, the Ferimat 711, the Drifsel ICR was bought. But then also, that was the Cyrotron, the Cyrotron, the Ferien Cyrotron.
Ferien
Cyrotron, drift cell ICR.
They call it drift.
Drift cell. You drift the ions under the influence of electrical and magnetic field.
Drift cell ICR.
Yeah, because we modified also a lot our cells on these machines.
Mm-hmm.
So let me try to tell it in an organized way. The drift cell had three sections, an ion source region, an analyzer region, and a detection region. Mm-hmm. That was a three-section cell. So it was sold by Varian, the Varian company in California. Mm-hmm. We made a four-section cell. That means an ionization region, then an ion molecule reaction region, yeah, mm-hmm. then an analyzing region, and then a detection region.
Okay.
So that was the first modification we did ourselves.
Okay.
To improve for ion molecule reactions, mm-hmm. yeah. Then, of course, the pumping system, as I mentioned, instead of ion getter pump, mm-hmm. also have a mercury pump. Mm-hmm. Also for the inlet systems, etc., to keep the vacuum as good as possible.
Yeah.
Also, we worked with a direct insertion probe. I think Maurice Bursi had also one, but I think we were one of the first to have a direct insertion probe
okay.
to measure in a drift cell ICR.
Mm.
I can assure you that, Mike, these were difficult experiments because, to find out whether a reaction was occurring, if it is exothermic, then you had a negative ion response because what you did, you played with the cyclotron frequency of the ion, and if you accelerated, then there was more product.
Mm-hmm.
But the signal had a sign, yeah. Charge transfer was always positive. Exothermic was negative. So with the direct insertion probe, where the pressure was so unstable, we needed to know whether the reaction was going yes or no.
Uh-huh.
So we had to see a so-called double resonance signal, they call. Hey? Was the double resonance signal ending up in a negative response, or was it positive?
Mm-hmm.
Positive for charge transfer, negative for a real, let's say, proton transfer.
Okay.
And we did that experiment with Joe Memel from the Polytechnic in London. He was for 1 month in Amsterdam. And then after 1 month struggling, all the time watching, I said to Joe in the end, that is also in the review paper, Joe, it is an exothermic reaction. The signal is negative. But since that time, we didn't use anymore the direct insertion probe. By the way, that instrument was also not used for analytical purpose.
Okay, sure.
Only research.
Yeah, yeah.
But for that particular case, it was important to see whether the reaction we thought it was going was really going.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And but that is an intermission statement. I don't know whether you know about dystonic ions.
Only that I've heard of them from Michael.
Yeah. Now, the dystonic ions, this is an ion molecule reaction where a distinction is made between a dystonic ion and a normal ion
mm-hmm.
via ion molecule reaction.
Okay.
Michael has also shown that in the beginning of his career.
Mm-hmm, right.
He had a cyclopropane ring with an amino group, and that turned out to be a dystonic ion in the end, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But that is, for scientific purposes, interesting then, yeah?
Now, obviously you can't run all this equipment, so you have students running it?
Students and, technicians.
Technicians.
Yeah,
so you were able to...
And later on, PhD students.
Okay, but you were able to hire technicians to
work? No, we had, in my group, we had Frans Pinks as we called it a lab assistant.
Okay.
But Frans was a lab assistant, I hope, we call it in the Netherlands, a chemical analyst.
Okay.
But then you know, but I think that term is not used in the United States, it's a lab technician.
Okay.
But Frans started as a lab technician in chemistry, but had interest in electronics. And therefore I managed to get them in my group not to do all the time measurements with the machines, but also to work on electronics, designing things with the instrumental workshop, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And that enabled us also, together with the instrumental workshop, to modify our instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And also with the help of Jim Dawson, who we'll mention later, but mm-hmm. Jim was a postdoc in my group based on a NATO NATO grant
mm-hmm.
in the beginning, coming from Keith Jennings' group.
Mm-hmm.
And so that helped to do things ourselves. So, for example, to listen, list a few things, on the MS-902, we made ourselves a so-called beta slit.
Mm-hmm.
To have a more selection of the ion beam, etc. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Then, on the Varian MAT field ionization, we developed a field emission control unit, ion emission control unit, to get stable emission of ions during field ionization.
Okay.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, in the end, we made the Fourier transform ICR. But that why that happened is again another story. PhD students did run the double focusing instruments,
mm-hmm.
also for their research, but also, and it was allowed by Professor Huisman and Professor De Boer, because Frans Pinkse went to designing and making electronic things.
How do you spell his name?
Frans Pinkse. Well, let's say, Frans is F-R-A-N-S. Frans, that is his forename.
Okay.
And then Pinkse, P-I-N-S-K-E.
Okay.
In the literature, he is F-A Pinkse. Okay.
And then there was this Jim...
Jim Dawson?
Yeah.
Jim Dawson.
A D, how do you spell his last name?
D-A-W-S-O-N.
Dawson.
Yeah, if you have problems, if you look in the... In the mass spectrometer review article, then you will find, or in the publication list, you will find the names.
Okay.
And then we had Mr. Roselaar. Yeah, he is only mentioned in the acknowledgments. Oh. He was an older man.
Oh.
R-O-O-S-E-L-A-A-R.
Okay.
He came from industry and knew Henk Hofman, his wife, and he was fired, and then he was hired at the university. So he entered mass spectrometry when he was 45 or 46.
Hmm.
But scientifically, he was not participating in the papers. He didn't want also, but for example, papers with the lab technicians, I put simply their names on it, because my attitude was always they have contributed a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You would say perhaps they should be able to defend everything, but I think if somebody has made a very good contribution, why not, hey?
Sure. That's fair.
That's fair. Exactly. That's the right word.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To be fair. And some of them have a very good training. Hey, believe me, the lab technicians are very well trained.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Yeah, and another one will come later on, I think, in the names.
Very good. The whole focus was to... do these applications in terms of people were submitting samples for the analysis, and that this would be an opportunity for the graduate students to develop their skills with the instrument and the interpretation.
And they used, of course, the instruments for their own PhD.
Right. And so did you end up having, every mass spec lab I know of has had those wonderful accidents where, the vacuum gets busted, broken.
Oh, yeah. we had an accident with a direct insertion probe on the Varian MAT 711. You know, these probes are very expensive, something like 10,000 guilders.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to shift them in, and then there was a valve, of course, that mm-hmm. locked the vacuum.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then when the direct insertion probe was shifted in, at a certain point, you had to open the valve
mm-hmm.
and shift it further.
Mm-hmm.
So the vacuum was not attached. Eh?
Mm-hmm.
But then somebody, and then when you have to put in another sample, then you have to withdraw the direct insertion probe, mm-hmm. close the valve,
mm-hmm.
and then you can get out the direct insertion probe. But what happened now? The probe was still there, and the person in question was a postdoc. He turned the valve, whereas the direct insertion probe was still there.
Mm-hmm.
So the direct insertion probe was really damaged.
Yeah.
So, and that was not easily to get repaired, because that had also these wires to heat it and cooling, etc. You know that.
Mm-hmm.
So we were not so happy with that.
Yeah, right. And then there's also the vacuum. Loss of vacuum unexpected.
Yeah, that in that case, the direct insertion probe was there,
mm-hmm.
But it destroyed the directed searcher probe and indeed the vacuum.
Yeah.
But then, of course, I get it as soon as possible further on and close it further. Yeah. But I must say, it had an iron getter pump in the end, the Varium Mod 711 instrument. And the getter pump has never been replaced until they threw away the instrument. Wow. That was in the 90s. But Mike, really, the Varium Mod 711 was an extremely well-designed instrument for analytical purposes. Mm. But there is also a problem. To modify yourself things, well, we did it. But for example, the software also, because it was analytically, later on even more, so made that you could not easily change it anymore. So they guaranteed a very stable working horse.
Yeah.
For your information, that is of course playing with the instruments. As soon as we started to do field ionization, then I would like to do field ionization kinetics.
Mm-hmm.
Where you could see decomposition of ions from picoseconds to microseconds in a time-resolved way.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, electroionization, there you have ions which stay in the ion source for a microsecond. Now the vibration times are 10 to the minus 12, 10 to the minus 13, something like that. So many reactions can occur for highly energized ions and lower energized ions. So it is if you take a picture with a camera and you do this all the time, it is very diffuse. But then with field ionization kinetics, and it was done by Al Burlingame and Peter Derek already, and in Beckeye's group in Bonn, but yeah, we got the source in 74. So field ionization kinetics had just been published. And field desorption, we could not get earlier than 1974, and then field desorption was already there. But with regard to the field ionization kinetics, first we had to develop a program to do a high voltage scan, and from there you could calculate the time where the ions had decomposed between the electrodes. Yeah? And so Chris Kort managed to write a completely new operating system for the Varian Mod 711. Yeah, but, and I can say to you, the guest scientist like John Bowie, he had been in our group, he was surprised to see that. I mean, we did analytical applications, but the next day we did pure research. And then an FIK scan, and immediately there was the phenomenological rate constant. So it was realized before we made that program, Jan van der Greve, who did field ionization kinetics by hand, that took 3 months to process the data. And then it turned out that he said, I should have better defined my molecular ion conditions. And that was easy when the program was made. But also, that was then field ionization kinetics. Field desorption is another story, because you know, tunneling of electrons from a molecule from the molecule to the emitter, you should not have high pressure. But now you go to field desorption, where you put a sample on an tungsten wire, activated tungsten wire, because that was used both in field ionization and in field desorption. And then you apply a voltage of 8 kilovolt difference, and you have the emitter loaded with your sample 1.5 millimeter from a counter electrode with a small hole in it. And then manually you have to put some current through it to heat the wire, and then ions are coming off. But if it is heated too much, suddenly you have an explosion of ions that will is a discharge, and the wire breaks, because a 10 micrometer tungsten wire is very fragile.
Yeah.
So in the beginning, when Frans did that, Frans Pinkse, the wires were broken because he could not manage that. And I said, Frans, stop, because these wires were about 300 guilders. So I said, stop, we cannot do that. So then, but I had been in Bonn also many times with the group that we went to Bonn to learn Beckeye, but also Carsten Lefsen and Hans-Rolf Scholten and Frans Rogen. So I had a paper with Hans Scholten on field absorption, and he used already emission control, mm-hmm. so that you could control the ion current coming from the emitter, and that was for operating the system, the mass spectrometer, much better, of course. Mm-hmm. Now Jim was with us, Frans was with us. As I said, I took also the lab technicians with me on these trips to visit labs. Not also well to conferences, but not so many times. Frans didn't want that. And it was also not custom in our faculty of chemistry that lab technicians went to conferences, sure. you know. Yeah. But when I made a visit in Bonn, that was no problem. We took the people with us. I drove by car. And then on the way back, I remember very well the discussions in the car with Jim Dawson and with Frans Pinkse. And then Carla Thijsling was a PhD student who and therefore doing collision activation studies. To discuss that there, and then in the on our way back to the Netherlands, then the design for a much better field emission control unit was discussed and made later on. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that has helped a lot to do field absorption. So you see the modifications, we were not afraid to do that, but always in a way. Especially for the instruments, if it was your own research, then you could do everything what you wanted, like the Drissel ICR.
Sure.
But with the AEIMS9 and the Ferien Mach 7 machines, you could not do riskful things, because if you would destroy the instrument, yeah. then the organic chemist would not have their analysis, and then the hell would break out.
Yes.
yeah?
Well, what do you think? Say we take a break.
Yeah.
Okay?
Okay.
Very good.
Yeah, because we are.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. But there are things, of course, which are